He must have simply loved those carefree days, careening around his neighborhood on his bicycle. All we need to do is listen to this music to sense the wonder he felt flying along Overbrook Avenue, where he grew up, knowing every twist and turn and bump and lump in the road there, in that close-knit community of Shavertown, just outside of Wilkes-Barre. But beyond what most children could even begin to experience, young Tommy's neighborhood was not bounded by streets a few blocks this way and another few blocks in the other direction. Because the Alexanders were proprietors of a fabled movie theater in 44th, Pennsylvania, not far from his home, Tommy grew up with a neighborhood that expanded on the big screen to include the world and even the universe. Remember the marvelous ride in the sky scene from E.T. where the boys were on bicycles breaking away from the band of big old authorities, sailing off into the sky over the sedate suburban neighborhood they called home? And so, when grown up, Tom Alexander looks back to his home from his longtime home in Miami. It's not only Overbrook Avenue in Shavertown, but also the 44th Theater, where he was nurtured among family and friends, and where he was launched into his career as a musician and composer, broadcaster, writer, and voice actor. And, just a little footnote, bring to mind, if you can, what those wonderful old professional film projectors look like. Two reels, or spools. They look like wheels. Well, flip or turn the machine, and you could imagine the two wheels of a bicycle. And that is a key image for us as we meet the music Tom Alexander has created for us in his brand new album titled Overbrook Avenue. Inspired, as he says, by my days where I spent the first 17 years of my life, Overbrook Avenue in Shavertown, Pennsylvania, from the earliest days of playing in the backyard to visiting my family's movie theater, this was home. Those childhood feelings of wonder, hope, joy, and melancholy were the center of this recording. The childhood suite begins with the movement titled Bicycle Days, continues with Play Outside, and If Only I Had. There's a piece titled Glimmer Glass, evoking a time watching the birds at sunset with his mother. There's a letter to Dad, but also pieces centering on music from the movies, like what Tom gives us from a film dear to his heart, Cinema Paradiso, Cinema Paradiso. And don't forget the lovely bicycle scene with young Toto getting a ride home along the country road in that film. We had a chance to speak by phone with Tom Alexander about his new album and how it came about.
In 2014, my mom, after a fairly lengthy illness, passed away. And so it sort of closed that chapter on a very important part of my life. And I kind of just felt that I wanted to kind of take one last look back, a little bit of a Valentine to all the people who populated that time and that place, my mom, my dad, uncles and aunts and other relatives and friends that I grew up with. And I said, you know what, I'm gonna sort of chronicle that in an album. And instead of a picture album, it was a musical album. So that's really kind of what I did. And so I think that sort of sealed it for me as far as the incentive to do it.
In tapping in, as you have, to those memories, because it's music and it's wordless, we can all sort of share together, even though our memories are not exactly your memories. But music in your life, little Tommy, when did you first pull up to a piano?
Oh, boy. I mean, really, really early. 2-3 years old, I think I was really attracted. I really came from a family of musicians. And so kind of all the relatives that I went to, there was a piano or an organ or something in the house. Musical. And so I was able to just walk up to that piano, and from an early point, I was able to pick out very simple little melodies and just had, I guess, an ear for it. So it was instant, really, for me. But there was a piano backstage at our theater in 44, and my uncle was a real fine jazz pianist, my dad's youngest brother, Tyke. And I would always sort of find my way back there and watch him play and listen to him play. And as I got a little bit older, and it was right after, believe it or not, right after the 1972 flood in Wilkes-Barre, that piano wound up in the basement of my house in Shavertown. It became my piano then. And I guess I showed enough interest in music that they said, all right, here you go. It now belongs to you. The piano fortunately escaped the floodwaters, and that's where it wound up. So that was it. And from that point on, I really got into it. It was a nonstop adventure.
And you were listening to your uncle, but you were also listening to movie soundtracks. What impact did that have? First of all, before we go to the movie soundtracks, tell our listeners about this very magical dream palace that was your family's.
Yeah, the 44th Theater, the building is still there. It's a medical arts building now, primarily an office building. Houses a lot of medical suites. But in 1938, my grandfather came out of retirement and built sort of a legacy theater for his sons. My dad, of course, being one of those sons. And so the theater was open for 50 years. And I came along in the early 60s. And from the earliest age, I just remember going in there and seeing movies on this gigantic screen and hearing music. And it was either whether it was the music from musicals or it was just the supporting score, written by, you name it, Henry Mancini or Bernard Herrmann or Dave Grusin or whoever it might have been, I was just captivated by the music and the movie. So images and sound were like on me at the earliest possible age, I think. And it was impossible not to be affected by that and influenced and inspired by that. And I knew early on, that's what I wanted to do in some capacity, whether it be writing or directing or music or something connected to it. And it was, you said it was magical, the magical palace. And it was, that's exactly what it was. I slept at my house. I've said this a million times. I slept at my house, but I lived at the theater.
And what that must have done for stimulating your own imagination, you were traveling around the world, around the universe, no doubt.
Yeah, no doubt. That's the case. That's very true because, this music could transport you, whether it be to some land far away here on Earth or even somewhere in outer space. No matter where it was, you were transported to that place. And it can be very small, intimate, warm thing or some vast landscape or whatever it was. It was just something that was always, the visual was always supported by some great piece of music. And it just was just enormously impactful. And my dad and his brothers really, really knew their business. They knew about movies inside and out. They just were walking encyclopedias, great storytellers, funny, warm, engaging people. And they also knew music. My dad was a huge classical music fan. My uncle, his youngest brother, was a jazz pianist. The other two brothers were also very, very into music and film and really knew an awful lot about it. So very lucky to have grown up around those four gentlemen.
And Tom, did they know what they were making possible for the community at large? Did they know they were inviting people in to have an experience that could change their lives or take them away from the drudgery of the daily lives? Did they think of their movie theater in those terms?
I think so. It was before my time, but I heard stories about what the theater meant to people during the theaters that they had. This is before the 44th Theater, during the Depression, and going even before that, and then later during the war, where people were just trying to escape. By the time I came along, those were sort of in the history books at that point. But there was always something, right, that, people want to, they're having a rough day, a rough week at work, whatever it is, you want to kind of just get those 2 hours away in a quiet, cool environment and just escape. And I think they were keenly aware of what it meant to people because they'd greet you and there were always the regulars. We knew 80% of our customers by their names and first and last. And they would come in and hey, how are you? And, you know, and they'd say, how's the movie? Is it great? And, you know, we would give a very frank feedback. You know, it's pretty good. You know, it's not the greatest movie on earth, but I think you'll have fun with it, or whatever it was. But they weren't really concerned with anything other than just being entertained for 2 hours. Maybe if they're lucky, inspired for 2 hours. So it was great. And I got to know those people, and I would ride my bike through the streets of 44th, and people would say to me, if I heard it once, I heard it 1,000 times. Hey, what's playing? Or what's coming in next week? And I feel very lucky and grateful to have been that kid that people sort of relied on to be the sort of the town crier for the theater, you know, kind of let them know what's going on.
And we have you on your bicycle in the music in this album,
yeah.
Bicycle Days. And we also have music that you arranged and put together for us from that marvelous movie. I guess they'd say it in Italian, Cinema Paradiso. When you saw that movie, is that your story?
That, boy, Erica, that is spot on. I mean, I saw that movie. Cinema Paradiso came out about a year after, just a little over a year after we had closed the theater in 44th, 44th Theater, and it was still very fresh, and quite frankly, I was always very saddened by the fact that we closed the theater. And when I saw that movie, I practically had to be, you know, carried out of the theater on a stretcher. It just really had such a huge impact on me emotionally, because that really was my life. Just substitute a little Greek kid for an Italian kid, you know. So much about it, the Italian culture and the open-air theaters and those kinds of things in Italy. I remember that when I went to Greece as a kid, when I was 8 years old. The same vibe, the exact same thing. And in fact, believe it or not, at an open-air theater in Greece is where my father decided to tell me my grandfather's story about how he came to the United States and how he built his first Nickelodeon and then adding more theaters. So seeing that film and the incredible score by Ennio Morricone and, you know, just amazing, the whole thing was just really like watching my life. It was, I almost felt like, did somebody spy on me? It was really pretty amazing.
And so you had to put something like this on the album that looks back to the time that you were being formed and your sensibility and your character and your dreams were being nourished.
No question. And, you know, just to sort of add a sidebar to that, I became a projectionist myself. And the man who taught me the ropes got his start in projection in the silent era. In the silent era. So, I mean, here's a guy that was working, you know, running a projection booth in the 20s. And here he is teaching me the tricks of the trade when he was in his 70s or late 60s, maybe, and showing me how to splice film and thread a projector and change the lenses and all those things that went into kind of making that seamless transition from one projector to the next, which was called a changeover in those days. And today, of course, it's all digital, and none of that makes sense to anybody. But it was a real art form back in the day. Being a projectionist was, you know, you had to have a little bit of an artistic sense to it and a passion for it, which I did immediately. And I learned from, again, this guy who was, you know, a master projectionist.
And what was his name?
His name was Phil Humphrey. And he was a great guy. He actually worked for years for RCA in Camden. He was also a great sound man. So when sound came in, he was there for a while and then returned to being a projectionist in his later years. But he was with us for a long time until, you know, health-wise, he could no longer do it. But I was just really lucky to have learned from a guy like him. And he had a lot of sons himself, and he was sort of like a, you know, another father figure to me. So it was just great being around those kinds of people.
And you tell us in the notes for the album, the actual tune titled The Projectionist, recalling the solitude of the projection booth. And you were there alone. You've just put things together and you're waiting for the changeover and that sort of thing. That was a meditative place. Tell us a little bit more about what we're going to hear when we hear this piece.
Yeah, the projectionist is that. It really does sort of capture the solitude, because there is a, in fact, even in Cinema Paradiso, in the film itself, they talk about the disconnect a little bit. You feel like you're sort of partly responsible to some degree for the audience's emotional response to the film, and that you're a little bit of a part of it, part of the reason why they're enjoying it. But at the same time, you know, you didn't make the movie, so you're just projecting it. But you almost take a sort of secondary pleasure in hearing their reaction, whether it's a gasp or a laugh or, you know, tears or whatever it might be. But it is a disconnect, and I think that's the solitude. It's like you almost have to step back a little bit. And, you know, I think that was something I was aware of as I got older. In the beginning, when I was just a young, very young man learning how to run the projectors, I was more concerned about, you know, not goofing up, just making the seamless transitions and making sure everything was running properly. But then as it became more second nature, I started to think about that, and I started to watch the audience's reactions and felt, and you were alone there. You know, you were there, you were really by yourself for 4 or 5 hours running a couple of different shows back to back. And you had a lot of free time to think about things. And I think a lot of my dreams were born there, in that room, watching movies over and over again and hearing dialogue and cueing off the dialogue and saying, oh, here's that line, I got to get up and change the reel, you know? And what can I say? I mean, it was a great experience. And one that I just would never trade in, ever. I mean, it was an amazing... I was very, very lucky to have a childhood like that.
How has film remained in your life?
You know, I still love movies. You know, I revisit old movies that I remember from years back, and I always am interested in what's coming out, and I watch it. I like to keep tabs on it. But most importantly now, fourth generation coming, my son, who's 19, is an aspiring filmmaker. He made a feature-length film in high school, and now he followed it up with the sequel, if you will, to his high school movie. And this meant that he went out and recruited tons and tons of his classmates and friends and convinced them to join him in this journey. And they did. And on a no-budget film, outside of sort of, except for the possible, you know, little dollars and cents that went here and feeding the crew and whatever, but it had no planned budget. He just went out and wrote the script himself, directed it, and rented equipment, and just made it happen. And his desire is to be a filmmaker. And he asked me, hey, Dad, will you score it for me, score the film for me? And I said I'd be thrilled, I'd be honored to do that, and I did. And he had his debut on the 18th of December, on Sunday the 18th, at a local theater. In fact, the last independent theater that's run by a gentleman who very much reminds me of my dad and his brothers. And he's got a little fiveplex theater that's here. And the premiere went great, and Peter was nervous and excited at the same time. But he's on his way, and I hope, maybe ahead of the curve a little bit on the process of getting into making movies. And hopefully he and I will have collaborations of a lifetime with making films and scoring films. And let's see what happens. Hopefully we do my dad and his dad proud.
Before we get to how you look back through your music to this area, I was curious about why now. You've been writing music, you've been playing music, but what about Overbrook Avenue now? Why now, do you think?
You know, that's interesting, Erica. I really had thought about doing some sort of a recording. I'd been doing a lot of stuff with my band, which is more electric and world music and fusion. You know, just a little more edgy, if you will. But I had always loved this kind of sort of, evocative, contemplative kind of music that I kind of recall from my days at our family's theater in 40 Ford. And it was, you know, real melodic and kind of soft and, again, I say evocative. It just really takes me to a certain place.
Well, take us to the album then. First, introduce us to your partner, John.
John Fifield is a gentleman that I met a few years back. He actually came to one of our gigs, our band gigs, and then he handed over an album that he had recorded. And he had a lot of real heavyweights on his album, guys that I really admired and looked up to, and real high-level studio musicians from New York and L.A., and I said, wow, this guy is a really terrific player. One thing led to another, and I said, look, I want to record a solo piano album. And he said, great. And I said, I know you've got a mobile studio. And he suggested trying out the piano in my house. And I was initially a little bit leery about it because it's an older piano. I wasn't sure if it had quite the right dynamics. But lo and behold, we gave it a whirl, and it really sounded pretty darn good. And as the music sort of evolved, I had written some of the music, and as the music evolved, I said, you know, John, I said, maybe we should just fill this out a little more, maybe with some, add some strings and maybe some guitar. And we tried it out, and it just clicked. And kind of look at each other and say, you know what, yeah, let's do this. So of the 11 pieces of music that are on this recording, Overbrook Avenue, six of them John is on. He plays on it on both acoustic and electric guitar. And he just has a great, keen sense of music and just the right playing. Now, this playing is very, it's very soft, you know, and I would say, again, I say evocative and just moody. But he also can play very fiery guitar, too. He's just a complete guitarist, all styles. He just attacked this music. He was just had the right sense exactly for what I was looking for, and actually even surpassed that. I would never have thought of the things he had come up with. So it was wonderful.
And you've created a tribute to Mom specifically, Glimmer Glass, and a letter to Dad for Dad specifically. So you were talking about this looking back.
It's fun. You know, we were able to find some old photos with family members. Those were cousins there. And a picture of Mom with me when I was a real little guy smiling, and she must be telling me something hysterical because I'm laughing. You could see that on all the on the liner notes. Remember liner notes, Erica?
Oh, I do.
We go back, date ourselves a little bit with the old albums, but that was part of the magic of getting an album. So I included a digital liner notes on this recording. But yes, Mom, very much part of that whole time. And she was really at the center of that, and Dad too, of course, with being Mr. Classical Music, and the whole time just, you know, being there. I wanted to kind of create these tone poems that were for them, you know, for Mom, for Dad, and just a musical sort of remembrance of them as people and what they meant to me in my life.
And speaking of your dad in classical music, I couldn't help but delight in hearing, as you begin the childhood suite, Bicycle Days, that nod to Claude Debussy and the Children's Corner Suite.
Yes, yes, no doubt. My dad loved the French and Russian composers. Those were his favorites. And when I was a little kid, I don't know, three maybe, he bought me the children's collection, Introduction to Classics or something. I don't remember the exact, but all I remember is it came in a green carrying case, and it had like 12 albums in it. And so there's Tchaikovsky and Rimsky-Korsakov and then, you know, Ravel and Debussy and Mozart and Brahms and everyone else. But it was great. And I would listen to these things, and he'd say, listen to that. I want you to listen to this. It's Peter and the Wolf or whatever it was. And, you know, just constantly just wanting me to hear stuff. And never in a forceful way. It was always in a real, you know, nurturing way. And, you know, isn't that great? Isn't that exciting, you know? And I loved it. I loved it. And so, yeah, those kind of tip of the caps to all those great composers throughout this record are there, sometimes very subtle, other times more blatantly obvious. But it's right there. But I can't deny the influence. It's unmistakable.
And tell us about the choice of the other film music, Close Encounters.
Yeah, Close Encounters. Well, you know, John Williams, arguably the greatest soundtrack composer. In fact, it's funny, before we were talking, I was talking to my son, and he was running down a laundry list of all the awards John Williams had been nominated for, because we talk about movies and music all the time, Peter and I. And it was just off the charts in terms of, I mean, it's just endless. And, you know, he was great. And the Close Encounters theme always struck me, this very simple theme, five notes. But yet, I thought, well, you know, it'd be fun to do an improvisation on that and just sort of take those five notes and see where it goes, see where it leads you. And I saw an old-time piano player who was a friend of my uncle's years ago. He would do improvisations based on people's phone numbers. And so, in other words, you would hit the tones on a push-button phone, you know, dee-da-dee-da-da-da-da, whatever it was, right? So he'd listen to it, and he would play that corresponding melody on the piano and then improvise off of people's phone numbers. I mean, this is a serious practice that this guy would do. And he would create these lovely, lovely themes, you know, stuff that would just make you cry. And I thought, that's a phone number, you know? So I said, well, I'm not going to go that complex. I'm just going to take the five notes from Close Encounters and see what I can do with it. And I just said to John Fifield, who was hitting play and record at the time in the studio, I said, John, I'm just going to improvise here. I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea, but I'm going to give it a shot. So what you hear on the recording is exactly what I played that day. And it sort of worked.
Early on in our conversation, Tom, you used the word place. And I am curious about evoking place in music. Now, you're evoking Overbrook Avenue and 44th and all of those memories and family in the mix. But what about music and place? Because so much of what you saw on the screen when you were a little fellow and growing up in the movie theater was soundtrack related to the desert in Lawrence of Arabia or something like that. Did you come to think about it in a different way, having completed the album?
Boy, that's a really interesting question. I think that sometimes there'll be a place, a physical place, whether it be something I'm imagining or something I'm recalling. And, you know, it will inspire maybe a melody. Or other times it'll work in reverse. I'll sit at the piano and I'll just start to improvise. And things will fall under my fingers sometimes, you know, these little passages. I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. Well, that reminds me of this. Or that reminds me of that. And so a lot of the compositions I write, not only songs that I wrote for this recording, but songs that I might write for my band, have titles that are places. They're streets, they're towns, they're regions, whatever they are. They'll be named after that. And I like to travel, and I find that inspiring. I find that places, whether they can be very small places, it can be an actual building, or a house, or it can be a street, or it can be a town, or whatever it is, they'll serve as the inspiration for a composition. And how I arrive there is varied. Like I said, sometimes it'll just fall under my fingers during an improvisation, or it'll be very, very preconceived, maybe, you know, where it's like, okay, I want to write something that sounds, that reminds me of this. And both those circumstances occurred on the Overbrook Avenue album. You know, the title track, Overbrook Avenue, is the street where I grew up, in Shavertown. And that kind of just happened. That was sort of sprung from an improvisation. And I just tweaked it little by little, and it just sort of revealed itself to me. I said, okay, you know what? This is it. This is the song that captures that time and that place. And that's how that kind of happens.
Just say a word or two for our friends in this area who might remember your friend and my friend Andrew Morell and his in helping you with the cover design and just your friendship.
Oh, yeah. Well, Andrew is a dear, dear friend, a real brother to me. We met, believe it or not, in a movie theater at the Kirby Center in downtown Wilkes-Barre. We were both going to see Howard's End, and we struck up a conversation. Hi, I'm a drummer. Hi, I'm a piano player. Hi, I listen to this guy. One thing led to another. A week later, we're playing music together. And a couple months after that, we had a band together. And that band lasted until we both left northeastern Pennsylvania, but continues to this day in our hearts. And we're, in fact, even going to reunite for some projects. But, you know, Andrew, of course, many of your listeners may recall, was a very important member of the staff there at WVIA. And he actually is also a tremendous, not only a great drummer, but a great photographer. and just has great artistic ideas and design. And he helped me put this digital booklet together and helped me construct it, and very much an equal, absolutely equal member in the construction of that booklet. So I owe him just everything on that. And he really remains such an inspiration to me musically all the time. I talk to him a lot. He's a dear, dear friend.
How can people find the album and get to know more about you and that sort of thing?
Well, sure, thank you. They can go to my site, which is TomAlexanderMusic.com. That's TomAlexanderMusic.com. Also, it's available on iTunes and other major digital distributors. It's digital only. There are no CDs pressed this time around. And I should say there is another Tom Alexander, who I believe is from Scotland, and he is an accordion player. Sometimes people mistake us for each other. That's happened, but that's okay. He's a great accordion player, but I'm the Tom Alexander that says Overbrook Avenue, and that's the name of the album. So that's where you can find it, on iTunes. And again, my site's TomAlexanderMusic.com.
Tom Alexander, musician and composer, broadcaster, writer, voice actor, and more, who lives in Florida but who grew up here in northeastern Pennsylvania, speaking with us about his new recording titled Overbrook Avenue, inspired by the first 17 years of his life growing up here in northeastern Pennsylvania in Shavertown outside of Wilkes-Barre, with tunes for his mother and his father, and those tunes remembering the family's fabled movie theater in 44th, Pennsylvania. For more information on the web, TomAlexanderMusic.com, TomAlexanderMusic.com, Overbrook Avenue,